come to the point where maybe he's using state employees as leverage to kind of get the legislature to act.
Government employees worry about a shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Dalton Highway is closed by flooding again.
The water that we're seeing up there is unprecedented. It's really hard to distinguish where the road is. It looks really just like a very fast-moving river right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Alaska is heading toward a government shutdown. That's the message Governor Bill Walker relayed to state workers in a letter warning them of budget vetoes and layoff notices. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports on the continuing gridlock over the state's finances.
In a press conference, Walker described the situation as unprecedented.
It's not where we'd want to be in any shape or form. It's not where we thought we'd be, where we would be.
He announced that he was signing the operating budget that the legislature sent him, but making large vetoes to it in the process. He said parts of government could shut down as early as July, and that up to 15,000 state workers could receive layoff notices in June. Most of state government would be affected.
DMV, license renewals, registration renewals, it just goes on. Workers' comp, it's a long list of impacts.
Walker's signed budget pays for the court system and prisons, for the Pioneer Homes, and for debt service to maintain the state's credit rating. But many agencies would see major cuts. Education would lose funding, and the state's Medicaid program would only make payouts for 6 months. Walker said the cuts were necessary because the legislature authorized $5 billion in state spending when only $2 billion are readily available. While Alaska has a $10 billion rainy day account for when the state faces shortfalls, a three-quarter vote is needed to access the funds, and lawmakers have not reached a deal to tap it.
We have the money. We just can't get sufficient votes or the budget to match so that they can access the funds that are there. Here we are with a AAA bond rating, and we're talking this scenario of a potential shutdown.
The Republican majorities and Democratic minorities are in a stalemate over education funding and the expansion of Medicaid. And no compromise has been reached on those issues 3 weeks into a special session. Walker said the amount in dispute comes out to about $100 million, just a fraction of the state's multi-billion dollar deficit.
While we are focused on arguing over 3%, we're not even looking at resolution for the 97% of the problem.
Pete Kelly is the co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. The Fairbanks Republican says his caucus does not want to add money to the state's operating budget and does not want to incorporate the Democrats' changes. He says they're the ones responsible for the gridlock.
It's only not fully funded because the House Democrats wouldn't vote to get into that savings account.
While Kelly did not provide specifics on negotiations, he did express optimism that a solution could be reached to avoid a partial government shutdown.
I don't think they'll have to have the layoff notices, because I think this can get fixed fairly quickly.
Meanwhile, Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, says that the Senate Republicans are the ones at fault.
The moment you have people like the Senate president saying he refuses to negotiate and everything has to be his way and it has to be a fully Republican budget, it's really hard to put together a bipartisan deal.
When asked who was responsible for the impasse, Governor Walker did not name any group, but simply said it was the legislature's problem to fix. Lawmakers are scheduled to hold a floor session in Anchorage on Thursday and will continue budget negotiations there. The deadline for the special session is May 27th. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Of the 16,000 state of Alaska employees, more than a quarter of them work in the capital city. KTOO's Lisa Fu went to the state office building and talked to state workers during their lunch break about their employment future.
Britton Burkhaus says her office at the Department of Health and Social Services was pretty quiet after getting the email from Governor Bill Walker about potential state layoffs.
I think we were all just dealing with the punch, you know, recuperating maybe a little bit. It wasn't a very good thing on a Monday, but, you know, woohoo!
Burkhaus isn't surprised by the email. The threat of a government shutdown and layoffs has been a possibility since the legislature recessed at the end of April. But she says it makes the situation seem more desperate. She thinks Governor Walker is doing the best he can, but
it's come to the point where maybe he's using state employees as leverage to kind of get the legislature to act.
Burkhaus is a grants administrator for the department. She says she makes sure nonprofits get money to provide services for Alaskans.
State employees do more than just show up to work every day. We actually help protect the life, health, and safety of Alaskans.
Mike Lewis has been a state worker for 15 years. He's a lead courier in mail services. Over the years, he's made sure Alaskans get their permanent fund dividend checks. He says the potential layoffs are all part of a game.
This is what they do. It's government. It's politics, which I don't like politics because of this.
And he doesn't think there's anything he can do, like contacting a legislator, to change the situation.
It's the big people up there that make all the decisions. I don't think they really care much about the little guys.
If he's laid off,
I'll go fishing, crabbing, all the things I can do when I'm off. But if it only a week, it wouldn't bother me that much. But if it's longer, then it's the financial thing, you know.
23-year-old Mackenzie Merrill just wants to have job stability. Before this email, she says she was getting other ones about positions getting cut. She's been an economist with the Department of Revenue for only 8 months. It's her first job out of college.
Like, I just signed like a year-long lease and I want to work here and I want to like save money for my future. And I went to college, like this is what I signed up for. And so like entering the state during a time of severe fiscal uncertainty has been like kind of disappointing.
Merrill has a vacation planned in July anyway, when layoffs could begin. But she'd like to know that she has a job to come back to. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The northern end of the Dalton Highway is closed again. A month after overflow from the Sag River shut it down, spring meltwater has made the only access road to the North Slope oil fields impassable again. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, an extended closure is expected as a rapid thaw has inundated the highway.
On Sunday night, the Alaska Department of Transportation announced a four-day closure of the Dalton Highway from mile 375 to 410 south of Prudhoe Bay. DOT spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says it was anticipated that overflow ice that built up this spring would cause major problems during breakup.
We expect the water to continue to rise until a point when it crests, and we're anticipating that will happen sometime late this week. And after that, we hope that the water will start to recede pretty quickly and we'll be able to go in and make repairs to the road.
Bailey says the DOT is prepared for serious road damage due to erosion.
But we also have a lot of equipment staged to make repairs after the water is done doing its thing.
Bailey says the worst area remains between milepost 394 and 405, but the closure has been expanded to take in a few other areas where there's water over the highway and to allow a contractor to stage repair equipment and materials. She says the section of main impact is completely covered by floodwater.
The water that we're seeing up there is unprecedented, and the pictures and video that we see, it's really hard to distinguish where the road is. It looks really just like a very fast-moving river right now, and it's not moving down the road. It's moving across the road.
Bailey says the state has been in communication with North Slope oil companies and the truckers who supply them, and they are prepared for the extended closure. After the flooding subsides and emergency repairs are made, the section of road is scheduled for major reconstruction this summer that will raise it 7 feet above the current grade. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, restrictions for salmon fishermen on the Kuskokwim.
Those tributaries have not done well at all, specifically in this drainage, over the last several years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Expecting another poor king salmon run on the Kuskokwim, the first fishing restrictions are expected to go into effect this Thursday. With the lessons learned from 2014, federal managers hope to strike a balance between bringing enough king salmon to spawning grounds and allowing for limited subsistence fishing. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
For the second year in a row, federal staff will manage day-to-day fishing on the Kuskokwim River from the mouth to Aniak during the king salmon run. 4-inch whitefish nets were legal 24/7 last summer, but this year they'll only be allowed for 72 hours around the weekend. The smaller mesh nets are intended to avoid catching kings during their run. Neil Lalonde is refuge manager and the in-season manager during the Chinook run. He says many people bought their nets over the winter and they'll be ready to fish. As there will be incidental kings caught, Lalonde says they're attempting to limit that impact.
We feel that if we didn't go to some type of schedule, that harvest could be much greater with the sheer amount of additional 4-inch nets that are here on the river.
The schedule is expected to last 5 weekends, beginning Thursday, May 21st. Nets can go in 6 a.m. Thursday and must be out by 6 a.m. on Sunday. Set net fishing will be closed the remainder of the week. Those closures will roll up the river beginning May 28th from Tuluksac to the refuge boundary at Aniak. Lalonde says the schedule came after visiting villages and talking with people this winter and spring. They chose the weekend schedule rather than a more sporadic schedule.
They would not have to pull nets in and out of the river every day. It does leave opportunity for honest people. Boats break down, there's a family emergency, things can happen. And we think that'll be easier on the users, and it will be more fair.
Managers will close fishing to all but federally qualified subsistence users, that is, people who live in specific communities on or near the Kuskokwim, a provision that's unique to federal management. Sport fishing will be closed. A new set of gillnet closures is anticipated for several tributaries. As of June 7th, there will be no gillnet fishing on the Kwikset, Kizaralik, Kasigluk, and Tuluksac rivers.
Those tributaries have not done well at all, specifically in this drainage, over the last several years. And that is an additional measure that we think will help the drainage-wide escapement as well as those specific tributaries. But we also took that into effect when we looked at all of the 4-inch opportunity.
Lalonde says that subsistence fishing is open now with no restrictions on gear until the first closures begin on the lower river. Lalonde says the plan for the first larger mesh openings in the latter part of June will be determined once the run is in progress and they see other species outnumbering king salmon. He plans extensive engagement with tribes and the recently established Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fisheries Commission, plus continued work with the state, which runs many of the river's monitoring projects. The state has responsibility outside the refuge boundary and for other species of salmon. The run is forecast to be slightly better than 2014, which saw the lowest subsistence take of king salmon on record. Lalonde says conservation and making escapement will remain the top priorities.
Our view is it's not a point estimate, but it is the upper end of the escapement goal range. That is our objective, and that's what we hope to achieve in 2015.
A link to the anticipated restrictions is posted at kyuk.org. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough's ferry MV Susitna has suffered expensive damage, and now the borough estimates repairs could cost as much as $1 million. The borough has been trying to sell the vessel for years and is negotiating with the Federal Transit Administration on the repayment of a $12 million grant. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
According to the Matsu Borough's port director, Mark Van Dongen, rainwater has damaged three of the ferry Susitna's 4 engines where it's currently being stored in Ketchikan. The damage was discovered in February and seems to have occurred during particularly heavy rains in late January.
It was over 5.5 inches in one day. And apparently some of that rain went into the exhaust manifold of the vessel. It went through the exhaust stack down into the exhaust manifold, and then water went into the cylinders in three of the four engines.
When the crew tried to start the Susitna for regular exercising of the vessel in February, those three engines failed. The ship has been docked in Ketchikan since 2011 at a cost of about $30,000 per month. Van Dongen was not specific as to why water was able to seep into the engines. Borough manager John Moosey says the vessel has been operating for 5 years without covers on its vertical smokestacks without issue, and it's not clear why the problem showed up this year. Moosey says what is certain is the insurance estimate on repairs will not be cheap.
We are working on the estimate. It's going to be significant. Anywhere from, I think, $500,000 to $1 million is what we're guessing.
The borough's policy carries a hefty deductible, $250,000. Mark Van Dongen says tarps now cover the smokestacks. He says plans to sell the vessel are proceeding despite the new chapter in the long saga of the Susitna.
And we're still attempting to dispose of the vessel either by transfer or by selling it as is. We could still claim the insurance money to do the repairs, but that won't happen until we have a buyer.
John Moosey says there's no rush for determining what to do next with the MV Susitna. He says once more information is available, he will take it to the Mat-Su Borough Assembly.
We're kind of a wait and see mode, and it's examining the situation. And once that is concluded, I'll report back to the assembly because this has sucked up a lot of energy and time, and I know my assembly it is a deep level of frustration.
Meanwhile, the borough is negotiating with the Federal Transit Administration on $12 million in grants the government agency wants back because the ferry was never put into service. The assembly held a closed-door executive session on the Susitna earlier this month and has scheduled another. For now, Mark Van Dongen says the borough does not have plans to repair the boat.
It appears that we're not going to until we have a buyer, and then we would negotiate with that buyer on the deductible portion based on what their offer might be for the vessel.
Van Dongen says ship brokers in Florida and Hawaii have contacted the borough about the Susitna, as has an individual in Texas. According to Van Dongen, another individual, a foreign national, has made an offer, but borough manager John Moosey says there are no offers in writing at this time. With help from Ellen Lockyer, I'm Philip Manning.
In Sitka, raising the hydroelectric dam at Blue Lake has created not only a source of renewable energy, but an even larger reserve of fresh water. The bulk water presents a business opportunity, and in drought-stricken California, a thirsty client. With a contract deadline looming that could terminate its exclusive rights, Alaska Bulk Water hopes to deliver on long-awaited promises to ship tankers of water and to make California its first customer. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Water coming out of a temperate rainforest, and frankly, I think the taste of the water here is better than any place else in the world. I'm kind of a water snob now.
Gary White is the executive director of the Sitka Economic Development Association. We're driving through the Tongass Rainforest, which averages around 100 inches of rain a year. The bulk water, and emphasis on bulk, was enough to incentivize a short-lived venture called True Alaska Bottling.
You get into Hollywood movies, if you look at the movie The Duplex, Ben Stiller's got a bottle of it sitting next to his nightstand.
And California is exactly where White hopes to send Sitka's water again. Not bottled in plastic, but delivered in ships. We hop out of his truck. Unfurled at our feet, like a glittering blue carpet, is Sawmill Creek, the freshwater outlet stream from Blue Lake, which provides hydropower and drinking water to the city of 9,000. Sitka already built the infrastructure to draw the water from the lake to the shore. It's behind us, a giant red nozzle poking up out of the ground. From there, a floating pipeline will carry the water into containers or special bags loaded on big cargo ships, just like oil. Sitka set the price point for water at 1 cent a gallon and can legally export 9.5 billion gallons a year. If you do the math, that's quite a bit of money.
If we move all 9.5 billion gallons a year, that's $95 million that could come into this community. That's huge.
The challenge, of course, is actually getting the water to market. Sitka's vision of a bulk water business began decades ago when the pulp mill closed. The city acquired rights to the land and to the water, and in 2006 signed a 20-year contract with True Alaska Bottling, which is now called Alaska Bulk Water.
We put in performance criteria that said after 24 months from the beginning of the contract that they had to move a certain amount of water or else the city at their option could terminate the contract.
The 24 months passed, and
no water was moved.
So the city renewed the contract, but under the condition that Alaska Bulk Water pay a non-refundable fee for water credits.
Pre-bought water, if you will.
In the past 9 years, the contract has been extended 4 times. And to keep it, Alaska Bulk Water kept buying water credits, $1 million in total. Still, no water has been moved. But White says that recent developments give him hope that water will finally leave the island this summer.
I've always been, I'll believe it when I see it, but when I see our current partners putting real money down to go out and put in a mooring buoy system and hire engineers to design it and, you know, going out and getting their Army Corps permits, doing all the right things and continuing to invest in the venture, then it's no longer just a 30,000-foot view of it. It's starting to get down into the details.
Terry Trapp, the chief executive with Alaska Bulk Water, declined to be interviewed in detail for this story. But over the phone with KCAW, he said the company hopes to have the operation up and running this July. In the meantime, White says there is a lot of troubleshooting to be done. For instance,
when you show up to a receiving port with 10, 20, 30 million gallons of water, what do you do with it? Right? You got to have a place to store it. You got to be able to recharge aquifers. You got to That's a huge part of this venture that needs to be figured out.
In addition to this storage question, it's unclear what kinds of ships will be used. White is looking to Alaska Bulk Water and several engineering firms to tackle these and other issues. He also wonders if, even at 1 cent a gallon, water is too expensive to transport at a reasonable cost. In order to hold on to this contract, Alaska Bulk Water pledged to ship 50 million gallons by December 8th, of this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The Native American Fish and Wildlife Society meets in Juneau this week. Tribal and other government officials and staff will discuss climate change, subsistence, Arctic policy, and dozens of other issues. Society activist Norman Hohola is the Natural Resources Manager for the Bureau of Indian Affairs Northern Pueblos Agency in New Mexico. He says the conference will address the role of traditional knowledge in resource management.
A lot of the Western knowledge tends to have them tell you what a certain species wants, a certain species needs, this is how they're going to survive. Instead of, to me, as traditional knowledge would go out, would look at the species, live with the species, and let the species tell you what it wants instead of you telling it what it's supposed to do.
Some sessions will focus on fish hatchery operations and lead ammunition poisoning in wildlife. Others will cover more recent issues such as policing, fracking, and dealing with meth labs. The Native American Fish and Wildlife Society meets Wednesday through Friday at Juneau's Centennial Hall. Hohola says cooperative management is important when tribes share borders. Alaska residents and a wide variety of local, national retailers gathered at the Denaina Convention Center in downtown Anchorage over the weekend for the first large commercial event related to the impending marijuana production and sales in the state. Called the Northwest Cannabis Classic, the weekend event didn't allow smoking or ingesting any marijuana, but the trade show featured marijuana-oriented retail products as well as information sessions for hobbyists and business owners hoping to navigate the future cannabis market. Alaska Public Media's Eric Quito brings us voices from the event.
I really came here not knowing what to expect. I'm Christopher Walton, and we're at the Northwest Cannabis Classic in downtown Anchorage, Alaska. I mean, as far as trade shows go, it's basically everything you could want in relation to marijuana except the plants themselves.
My name's Alex. I'm here with Silica Glass. We're from LA. Yeah, we ship out a lot from LA, like all over the country. So, I mean, Alaska is a brand new market, so we like to see how it is out here, meet everybody personally, and let us, you know, let everybody know that, you know, that we're out here.
My name is Craig McCarty. I'm with Alaska Lighting and Supply. Well, the atmosphere is all over the place. I mean, we got the hobbyists. You know, we got people that are interested in starting the commercial grows, getting in the industry as it's coming along. And, you know, it's still a learning curve for everybody because we don't have regulation yet.
I'm Harry Caruana. I'm with Eagle River Professional Tax Services. The dichotomy between federal prohibition and state legalization, I mean, it's just difficult to operate in that gray space. People are generally aware that there is a punitive tax rules that are out there and that they're going to have to manage them. And people are excited to have somebody that can help.
I'll definitely be back tomorrow. I got a weekend pass. But I was pleasantly surprised at the variety of information, of products, of literature on the subject. And I'm very glad that I came.
A video of the weekend cannabis event is at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Eric Quito in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message is sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.